So it's really, really, really lovely to be back in Oakville because I've been away for nearly 2 years now, so out in the wilds of North Cork. So thank you very much to Paul for inviting me and for Shane for hosting us and all Oakville people making me happy. So I'm really excited to be reading with Victoria tonight because there's particular, I like her particular poem of hers actually like stays in my head when I'm in fitting rooms, White Whale, in a way that makes me stop being horrible to myself, so I have to say thank you to you for that poem, before I think about it anymore and start crying. So just to make us all cry, I have sort of a poem that's kind of, I wrote it ages and ages ago. It was one of the first poems I had that had any kind of proper response to it, as in like I could get it published, that kind of thing. But I think it enters into a kind of conversation with Victoria's poem, White Whale, in a way. And it's called Panda. It takes place in China when I was visiting a friend who was teaching English there. So there's one word, qipao, which is a dress that has high collar, kind of a traditional Chinese dress that's referenced. So, Panda. My girlfriends are surrounded by silks, and I am outside looking in on this library of the feminine. There are rolls of ruby and cherry blossoms, cool sapphire dragon pools, and jade envy forests. Manuals to be chosen from just beyond the stall of heady spices in the Duyun-covered market. I shuffle softly to hide my girth behind a butcher block table while the seamstress giggles fingertips to lips at the numbers that measure my friend's willowy western lengths. They're souvenirs, handmade qipaos, dresses with slender eastern cuts that lend an instant image of exoticness. My souvenir, fear of the tape wrapped wide around my hips, my thighs, my belly, marking the size of a true panda, Chinese slang for Westerner, or the name of an animal which is black-eyed, weary, fumbling, unapproached, unapproaching. So of course everything's totally fine now and I'm totally well adjusted. it's poetry, right? So my next poem is kind of a companion piece in that it's about the hell that gyms are, that just, they're my least favorite place in the world because I have this thing of getting really overwhelmed by too much stimulation. And you know, when you've got like a whole like line of mirrors over here and people looking at themselves and sweating, and then there's always those three TVs playing the most horrible things, and it's really, really loud. I just get overwhelmed and then I have to go away. So this poem is inspired by that hell. And it's trying to replicate how the noise is coming from lots of different sources. So if you saw this poem on the page, there's sets of three lines, three lines, three lines. So you'll have TV, what's happening on TV1, on TV2, and then the noise coming from somewhere else. So this poem is called Workout. TV1, Sierra Leone on lockdown. TV2, a man clutches a woman's ponytail, a horse's rein. I set the elliptical to intervals. Ebola virus could become a bioterrorist threat. She'll eat your heart out like Jeffrey Dahmer. I make a comparative study of other women's arms. 50 Shades of Grey hits the 400 million mark. A woman plays cello in a black lace bra. Over the waistband, my belly sags like an awning in a rainstorm. Twitter feud destroyed my life. Yes, I'll be whatever you tell me when you're ready. I increase my resistance to 8. Start to lose my breath. So as you can tell by now, if you don't know me already, I'm a Yankee, and I come from I come from St. Louis, Missouri, where the symbol of our city is the arch, and it's a big silver arch. And it's particularly funny to be a thing that honors the city because it acknowledges that we are the gateway to the West, which means it's celebrating the fact that people are moving through to get somewhere else, you know? So when I try to, there's a lot of mythology around what it means to be an American and a lot of over-romanticizing, and so I'm trying to interrogate what's actually happening with some of these romantic things like settlers. And I was trying to think about what does it actually mean to be from the people who decided not to go any further, just to stay there, you know? So this is called Settlers. My ancestors found the word pioneering, a map to a reckless country, all trails ending in gold lust. Not for them, the green breast of the new world, better a homestead near a muddy river to perfect the craft of traps, the sale of flesh and fur. They fed offerings to the ravenous currents, broken wagons, rebellious slaves, spent horses, any body yoked to sorrow. Every Sunday they wove baskets of prairie grass to sail empty down the water, lifting a song of praise. Make my home in Saint Forget Me. On the banks of limbo, give me an eternal bed. So I want to kind of flip the romanticism and make it a little, look at the darker side of where that all came from. I have a more personal poem. There's a quilt that my great-grandmother made that I wanted to write about. There's a particular spelling error in this quilt. It's like a family tree. And instead of saying someone was born, it says borned with a B-O-R-N-E-D. So, yeah, that kind of kicked this poem off. It's called Inheritance. Piety is for sale on historic Main Street, where mock Amish quilts boast humility blocks, honoring God by deliberate error, one square turned contrary to the larger pattern. In my mother's kitchen, a fond confession is folded tidily over an oak rack. Great-grandmother's work isn't fussy cut, refuses patterns, no broken stars, no log cabins. Stitched simply in squares to mark each family birth with the best of a farming woman's education. Mary Pledger Fowler, born 1892. Wanda Lee Bice, born 1938. And the punchline to that poem is that my error, my unintentional error written into this poem, is that when we went home to visit and I looked at the quilt again, it's really complex. It took a lot of skill, and that just shows my sort of ignorance about, you know, just because something's not spelled right, somebody doesn't have an academic education, then you say, oh, simplicity. So I really want to write a companion piece to about how the errors just to actually show that what a craftswoman she was. Okay, so as Shane very generously mentioned, my chapbook is available at smithereenspress.com. It's free to read, so why not, you know, give it a try. So what was weird and wonderful about that process is having somebody else look through your poems to say, suggest which poems might go together in a small way, and weirdly, I didn't think I was wrote about domestic things very much, but a lot of my poems are just like looking at home and homes that are falling apart or homes that are coming together or that kind of thing, so it was surprising. So I highly recommend trying to put your poems into a shape to see, you learn more about what you're trying to get at. It's interesting and horrible. this is from a past life. It's called Starter Home. Alone on a mantle coated in dust, a child of Prague won't meet our gazes. You think the nest and the fireplace romantic. I trace the wall's moldy cracks to their conclusions. Dead ends and cobwebbed corners. A bee bashes his soft body at the other side of the window, testing again and again the invisible barrier. Not yet woken from what-ifs, we walk the small road to the beach, single file, keep clear of cars rushing home. Facing the ocean, we sit side by side to play make-believe. Old as we are, calculating every imaginary resource save the change in my pocket. Silent, I dig my feet into the sand, you bury your hands before us, waves tumble and breast, failing, failing, failing to leave the shore. So this next home poem is about a much better, situation with a person. but we're in this ridiculous house that was falling apart. And the one word I might explain ahead of time is, I thought everybody knew this word, but some people haven't. So Rorschach test is the psychological test. That's an ink blot. You press the pages together, you look at it, and you try to decide what it looks like, and apparently somebody can tell what's wrong with you. I don't think it holds up screens, but I'm not a psychologist. So this poem is called Tenancy. It's a little ode to being a renter like myself. Tenancy. Rentals have no grandchildren to attend creaks and drips. So long as the skeleton stands, the house is self-sufficient. The entrance wall weeps where the neighbor's chimney has crumbled in disrepair. Bricks sprout a wake of weeds. Terraced gutters are clogged with a hairline of grass. Into the bedroom, ivy creeps under the windowsill. An encroaching strand, unwelcome as newly sprouted ear hair. Fungus blossoms, a worship test above the bed where the ceiling is befuddled under an exposed attic to be covered in emulsion upon tenant complaint. We are told cosmetic concerns, expect mold and damp. We don't mention the seance knocks of walls settling, the dirge of pipes clanging for visitors. Since it's a horrible rainy day, I'm sorry I'm so negative, but you'll get lovely Victorian thing. So because it's a lovely, horrible rainy day, I've got a horrible rainy day poem about how much sun we really need. So this is called SAD, like seasonal affective disorder, and it just talks about how rain sucks. Okay, SAD. My disorder in the sunless fortress of brown stairs and blue bodies, I'm told, is to blame on a lack of vitamin D. Worse are the poisonous positive ions on the computer screens, unhappy mirrors gazed into for days, weeks scrying eventualities, soaking up full spectrum gossip, up to the minute depressants and political affective contorters. The solutions, milk with a green cap, saline baths and magnetized pools, high-intensity yoga aerobics to sweat out ill will, stagnant karma, and negative I statements. Following my yogurt pod of drinkable serotonin to supplement my deficit of connectivity, of chemical facility, those leaps of light I crave from neuron to neuron, but thriving somewhere behind my shaded winter eyes, mood-sucking, light eating machines. I have a poem about the Elysian. The skyscraper that's on the edge of town. And when it was being built, there is sort of the panels outside to keep you from running into the construction site, and there was this ridiculous piece of graffiti on the construction site that said, and it's, you'd see this anywhere in the world, skyscrapers are gay. And who was visiting me at the time but my friend from California, Brandon, who was in for the Dublin Gay Theatre Festival, who was playing Jesus, actually, but if Jesus were a gay man. And he's such a Buddha, he saw it and he just laughed. He's just like, all right, skyscrapers are gay. So I thought about it for, it's stuck with me for so long, and then I just... I said I'd kind of take that statement, the statement of the graffiti, to its absurd conclusion and try to figure out what was actually going on behind the sentiment. So the
I know, why would you? Why
do that?
Thank you so much.
Well, I know, yeah, right? that's the definition of what you're saying.
Yeah.
Thank God for getting it out on paper. Okay. So the title of the poem is what the graffiti says, skyscrapers are gay. Used to be you didn't see them in public. They just keep themselves to themselves. Some said they just didn't exist. Why would you need a skyscraper when a bungalow would do? Or if you need to spread up, a two up, two down, with just enough room for two kids, maybe three. A bit of a garden at the back with an apple tree, bleeding hearts, lily of the valley. A shed for keeping sharp or rusted tools, a place for the man of the house to lock himself in with silence. Used to be, if a skyscraper was in your parish, it would collapse all its floors down like an accordion, sighing as the air was squeezed out, making itself into a decent foundation for a public house or GAA club. And everyone knew what was underneath, and the right thing was to quietly let it be. Nowadays, they just impose themselves on the city, sticking up so tall everyone can see that modern green making old things look shabby. And of course, when one comes, others follow. I'll tell you what skyscrapers are like. They're like the woman who won't take off her big hat at a wedding. They're like the loudest child in a Christmas play. They're like the Tower of Babel, or is it Jacob's Ladder? Imagine the boldness of bilging your way up to the heavens as if you had the right, as if someone was calling you up. Okay, last poem. It's another court poem, and it's about another past life of mine when I used to be able to come to Oviedo every Monday and get into a taxi really drunk with big, dirty curry chips and cheese. And now I have a 2-year-old, so I have to get up at 5 in the morning. So this is a little homage to that time, and also a warning about a particular quirk taxi driver that you should try to avoid. And it's called The Good News. Long past final call, too late to look for what had gone missing in the pub under abandoned scarves and broken umbrellas. So I climbed into a car, tongue numb, slurred directions home. The taxi man laughed, his numbered ID flapped on the dash. On the smudged mask of my face in the wing mirror, my eyelids were blind, were blinds on a lazy roll. As we flew, each turn upset the tide in my head as holy metals gossiped and tisked from the rear view. I counted lights till home, each green a blessing. We stopped makeup and phone. When we stopped, makeup and phone spilled in search for fare, and the driver flashed me a Trojan smile, told me he had a gift, and reached into the console between us for a clutch of pamphlets that promised good news. He exchanged his beliefs for my cash and asked as I reached for the door, "Do you love the Lord?"
Thank you, Jennifer Matthews. Please, Victoria Canfield.
Is that out my mouth? good evening, everybody, and thank you, Jen. That was just super duper. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. It's great to be back in Cork. I am a Cork woman. I bleed red, obviously. and I am an exile in County Kerry, which is very pleasant, but you know, it's not Cork-like. So I am going to read some poems from my pamphlet, White Whale, as well as some new poems. And this first one is actually one that is about the sea, and as White Whale suggests, there are many sea poems in my pamphlet. And it's about Ballycotton Pier. I'm from Shanagarry in East Cork, and Ballycotton is our nearest, more picturesque, I say that resentfully, town. So we are obviously always livid and jealous, and they were called the Ballysnotners. So this is about Ballycotton Pier. Bright lemon day, our eyes water. Dad takes us to the pier. I don't know where he found the rods, and without showing us how, we cast off into silty sea where humpback rocks congregate. I don't want to catch anything. Imagine something slimy will take the bait. A tug. Dad shouts instructions. I reel in the line. The fish's mouth plucked above the surface blows desperate kisses into air. Tangled, the dogfish pants. Smacks the swell, swims around itself. Dad says it's a bottom feeder. So we cut and snap. Watch the fish, white-bellied, bitter and hooked, escape back into the depths. At dinner, I squeeze a segment over fish I will not eat. Squint my eyes at splattering juice. The hook in my heart judders all at sea. We both carry it, piercing into ever deeper water. It's kind of strange that Jen mentioned Beach Vale, because it's a poem that, I suppose it was like my gateway poem into the sea and whales and all that sort of thing. And the body, the female body. So it was also one that came to me when I was going to sleep one night, and I wrote it, the first draft of it at least, with the light off, just writing in the dark. And I think it allowed me to say things that maybe I wouldn't normally have had the courage to say, for me anyway, at that time. And it's also a poem I can never say when my mother is around, so I rarely read it, because she's always very supportive when it comes to my reading and everything. So I dedicate it to her with thanks for being very understanding and allowing me to use her in my poems as I do. Beached Whale. At first I thought that enormous lump of red-brown on the sand was the trunk of some ancient washed-up tree. It was only when I mounted the object, digging my little hands into something far too pliable, that it hit me. The stale smell of a thousand low tides and the mute open mouths of the many onlookers with their hysterical dogs, the seagulls circling like squalling clouds, my mother's curlew scream as she ran towards me, disjointed. Astride the whale like this, looking at my mother move through dimensions, planes of distance, I thought of boutique dressing rooms filled to the brim with tension and clothes like gas expanding, and two little girls watching their mother cry at a reflection distorted in a fluorescent mirror. The weight of her past made flesh on her hips, the scars of our arrivals barely healed after all this time, my blind hands all over the body, grasping, desperate to hold on to something real, not knowing what that was. I was a very good girl in school, just in case you were in any doubt of that. And my friend, well, she was a girl who moved, she moved to the school, and she was a little bit wild, shall we say. And I was sitting next to her to be a good influence on her. And, you know, what do teachers think is going to happen? It was obviously the other way around, and I had a great time. It was wild, man. Fifth class. So I dedicate this to her because I suppose she showed me a different way of being at that young age, and she excited me, and she was a really inspirational person for the short time that she was with us. So I dedicate it to Bernadette, and I always feel like when I'm moving on with my adult life, I always think of her and kind of feel like how unfair that she was robbed of it. So I often read this poem to just kind of maybe acknowledge that she was here. Zero. Our houses were twins once, side by side, squinting over the valley. I'd watch them from below, imagine their windows opening to touch. You'd pretend to run away forever, when really you hid in overgrown grass, dark eyes glinting above bleached weeds. You made me tell your parents you were lost. We attended separate schools. On the bus home, I sat up front, a heavy bag denting my thighs. You stayed down the back, your satchel dangling like a hollow eye, my name in Tippex on the strap. That spring, the funeral bell moaned for you, rolled around our valley like a crazy marble, shattering the windows of our houses, lace curtains signaled through broken glass. No one hides in the grass. My name's flaked away. I spend the summer of my 16th year at the disco, watching the shadows of others press together, flatten themselves against the wall. I hate domesticity. is another thing you should probably know about me. I don't know, does anyone actually like it? Like these people who like cooking and all of that sort of thing. Do some people like it? Excellent, that is wonderful. Because I don't understand. I seem to resent a lot, but it's not my natural state. Thank you, Jen. No. So I rebel against it and get very cross about it. And I blame this incident. And again, my poor mother features in this. Sorry, Mom. I also never read this poem when she's here. Iron Dragon. Mother at the ironing board, washing foams at her feet, shirts to be steamed into submission. She pulls one out, stretches its striped skin across the board, licks her lips, tuts a talk show drone. A cat purrs against the glass outside, the window full of it. Beyond, dark green leaves mantle my mother. She shimmies the iron into hard-to-reach places. In small gaps, I think I see where sea turns into air. The iron's fat plastic body conceals its metal tongue, pointed with holes like buds for tasting. It licks all the wrinkles out, wraps its long, thin tail around us. At his everyday ring, she runs, the beast hot on his shirt. I reach up. The creature's breath scalds. At my scream, she drops the phone. Her slap on my thigh, we both cry. I touch the burn later. It's flat. Scaly, dragon skin. Dun, dun, dun. Now I'm going to wow you all with some new poems. Only a few, don't worry. So I have a younger sister, and I think my mother trained me to really love her so much that I would take a bullet for her. It's a visceral love. I don't know, maybe it's like, I'm not a mother, so I don't know, maybe it's like a feeling of being somehow a mother to your sister, I don't know, but I love the girl. So she asked me a while ago never ever to write a poem about her, or put her in a poem, and she has, you know, flirted in and out of various poems, but this is her first poem. So she has read it and she was relieved, so it is called Extension. With footprints light as a cat's, my little sister, no more than 4, padded through freshly poured concrete in her new summer sandals, the ones with daisies punched through, her toes petals on the lip. The sun gawped at her perfect shiny head. Louise, I watched you stand in the middle of that grey square, a fluttering tissue in white, your fringe kissing the long, curious curl of your eyelashes. Your creamy contentment at reaching the centre and remaining there a spell, until our mother saw you, roared at Willie the Builder, then at me, never at you, how could she? And waded in past the wooden boundary, going to you as you set in concrete, bending down to unstrap the beautiful sandals, small monuments to your bravery encrusted on the foundation, matching trophies on a mantelpiece. She landed you back on the tarmac where you grinned neat milk teeth at me, sobbed a little to our mother, waved to your sandals as if from a train. I love her. She was, I will tell her, you know, I was telling everyone how much I loved you, and she'd be like, oh God, Vic, really? So, I've been a vegetarian since I was 7. Really annoying child in every way. And I've never really thought about it very much until this latest batch of poems, I suppose. And a lot of them deal with meat and food and the female body. And obviously if you're a vegetarian, at some point you have to be annoying in someone's house and say, do they know I'm vegetarian? I'm going to make sure somebody tells them because it's really awkward. So this is my coming out story as to why I am a vegetarian, and it's featuring the English market, so it's kind of appropriate. Meat market. I sucked marrow from bones at dinner, my father's face a bloody grin of pride. I ate liver in chunks for breakfast, pink and firm, jewels to adorn my insides. I gloried in the feel of flesh, the exertion of the chew. Holding my mother's hand in a Christmas rush, I saw them hanging upside down in the English market. Turkeys like chandeliers, partially plucked, bruised purple eyelids, dainty light bulbs. Struck dumb, mother patted me. There, there. I refused to eat meat, became pillowy, meek. Found strips in mashed potato, its tang in soup. I could sniff it out, my own blood too. I bled young, learned how to swing from butcher's hooks. For sale, anemic. I have a very understanding husband. And when, you know, I told him I was vegetarian, I was anemic at the time, and I had a vitamin B12 deficiency and all of these exciting things that were basically a result at the time of not eating properly. And he was very patient and, you know, tried to bring me back to the meat way. But, well, this is for him in, I suppose, my gratitude in the way that he can handle a lentil. Despite being a meat eater, a la carte. In Cassidy's restaurant, I watch you saw a hunk of meat on white porcelain. Your winking knife presses down, relieving muscle from fat, transparent and soft as toothless gums. This steak, open like a palm, wants you to eat it, is begging even. I have not eaten meat all my adult life. It's red juice, an embarrassment. But now I cannot look away. The fillet pulsates on your plate, salivating. Would you like a bite? You say, extending a sinew on the prongs of a fork towards my lips. In front of me, leaves, nuts, seeds, a wadge of goat's cheese. To be honest, I say, I'm starving. So I've been married for about 2 years, and I have relatives, and those relatives are really interested in what's going on with my womb. As creepy as that sounds, they say things like, and things stirring. Which is just like, so I just one day was like, okay, I need to really, you know, explore this a little bit. Explore my womb. So this is called Daughter in Waiting. You are tugging at my skirt, aged 2, wanting a toy, a spoon from the drawer. You are a few months old, just able to hold your big old baby head up on the teensy neck. It is your birthday. I am sweating and empty. You are covered in goo, rising and falling with my breath. I survived, and you did too, and your father is crying. We are a little family, neat as a pin. Except you are still waiting, Portia, or Lucia, or May, in parts. I carry a tiny piece that I secrete so secretly every month, and you grow impatient when water turns that warm and brilliant shade. It is alive while you are not. Daughter-to-be, if you could form your hands into little fists, you would bang on my womb, that carpet-lined waiting room. But your father has your fingers, and I have wrapped your nails up so you can't rip me to ribbons. We keep you apart, even as we come together. But I hear him whisper your name, soft as a cloud in his sleep. So there. So this last poem is about premenstrual syndrome. And I just want to dedicate this to my friend Nikki, because he asked me to dedicate a poem to him. This one's for you, Nikki. And also, I just wanted to thank Paul and Shane so much for, and Jen, for such a great night, and to all of you for being such a wonderful audience, and for your time and for your attention. And also to thank poetry, because I don't think if I didn't write poetry, I would be standing up in front of lots of strangers and friends talking about premenstrual syndrome. And there's something kind of brilliant about that. So, because I don't get premenstrual syndrome, I get it, like, right now. Never before has it ever, etc. But I don't, we don't talk about it very much, other than to say, oh my God. So this is my attempt to try and figure out what. PMS in Town Park. I wore those shoes I never wear, forgetting why I never wear them, until after walking into town, my heels and the sweet spots under each ankle where they smile were bleeding. At least there's some sign, I thought, trying to breathe through a too tight waistband, its elastic pattern imprinting dominance in livid red lines. Heavy as guilt, my slack-jawed handbag pulls, a demanding toddler pushing the right bra strap further into shoulder flesh. This garment bridging my back is not fit for purpose. Constraining breasts that are not mine, surely. They spill, quiver, wobble, no words that don't suggest sex. Swell. I am wary of carting this carcass. I go to the park. The roses are starting to die, thank God. I pluck a tight slipping down my waist, saggy at the crotch. Weird pointed toes poke through their denier blackness. Undressed, I would see ridges of wire, seams smiling on bloated skin, pounds up. Fertility is fattening. I sit on a bench, sigh how tired I am to wilting flowers, how I pick holes in my spouse as if he were a garment to adjust. I want to be altered, taken in, taken up, hemmed instead of all this emptying and filling. I count out my life in units of 32, start again at the end or beginning of a month, except this one. I wait for my period in the park, not for a baby, this isn't a poem about that. Brain hot. An empty oven left on. I remain calm, as somewhere sirens scream, furious, and all around singed petals fall like tongues. Still, my heels bleed. I bite my nails, tearing at the small moons. Thank you so much.